This is Mountain Escapes, a backcountry podcast, connecting backcountry enthusiasts like you with the legendary backcountry lodges of British Columbia, Canada. Each episode, we highlight one of BC's unique backcountry lodges through conversation with the lodge owners and operators.
One of the world's finest alpine settings.
Everybody has to have a transceiver, a shovel, and a rope.
Mountain Escapes, a backcountry podcast. Your host is Brad Harrison, who's worked and adventured in remote settings his entire life. He's the executive director of the Backcountry Lodges of British Columbia Association, former owner-operator of Golden Alpine Holidays, and current owner-operator of Call West Alpine Adventures. Now, here's Brad Harrison. My name is Jeff, and I'm normally the producer of the show, but today we thought we'd turn the tables and interview the regular host. As you heard in the opening, he's a seasoned backcountry guide who has owned lodges, toured extensively throughout the BC backcountry. He's taught avalanche safety to hundreds of skiers and snowboarders. He's the owner of Call West Alpine Adventures and is also executive director of the Backcountry Lodges of BC Association. Somehow he finds time to host his own podcast, too. Please welcome to the show, Brad Harrison.
Hey, Jeff, how's it going?
It's going great. Just for people that don't know, Brad and I connected through a couple avalanche safety courses a number of years ago now, including an AST1. And a couple of years later, he led an AST2 plus course near Blue River that I was lucky enough to be a part of. First off, Brad, tell us about your early beginnings in the backcountry. You started out at a really young age because your dad was a horse packer. It was around Invermere.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Invermere, Jeff, and my dad had a hunting territory up in the north or the headwaters of the Kootenay River. So I was really fortunate to have spent a lot of time at a very young age, single digit age, with my dad. I was a last child, so really I was the only one to hang out with him. So I was incredibly lucky to spend time in that pristine environment.
So the other kids in your family, they didn't follow similar paths?
They did, but we have a big age gap. They're, the next closest sibling is 16 years older, so they were off with their own families by that time.
And tell me about what he did around that area and how you got started.
Well, he's a bit of a legend, or maybe not just a bit of a legend, he's a real legend. He had a hunting territory, so he was a hunting guide in the fall, and then he was a horse packer going way back. Like he actually hauled freight and mail from Golden to Revelstoke before the highway was in, which at that time was a 5-day trip, 4 to 5-day trip around the big bend before the Rogers Pass route was in. Perhaps the mail got there faster at that time, but he worked with the likes of Conrad Kane and the Feutz brothers and with all those kind of early climbing legends.
Did he drag you along on some of these tours?
Oh yeah, once I was old enough, because by that time my brothers who used to help him on the trail had gone. So I got to be the heir apparent to, riding on the back of a pack train and trying to keep the horses in line. By that time he was down to 30 to 40 horses. In his heyday, he had 120 horse pack train, if you can imagine. That's a lot of horses to manage. Hunting season, as you know, in BC is open generally in the fall for most species. So he would do the packing. He worked with the Alpine Club of Canada with their general mountaineering camp hauling supplies, providing, chefs and cooks and all that kind of stuff, wrangling.
And what did all these people around him think of you being in the mix?
I was mainly a pain in the ass, to be honest, especially when I was younger. But I definitely had lots of fun, for sure.
Tell me about some of your favorite memories with your dad.
Well, he was just an amazing person that had, I don't think I ever got spanked in my life because you just had to have so much respect for him that you never wanted to displease him. You always wanted to make sure he was satisfied with what he did. So he didn't really have to use any kind of corporal punishment to straighten me out when I likely really needed it.
You must have developed your work ethic from him.
Yeah, I definitely had I had a role model that it was so easy to look up to and try to aspire to the standards he set, which were pretty much impossible, but it gave me a target to try and work towards.
And was he a skier?
He was not a skier. In fact, he didn't really participate in what we would call nowadays sports, right? It was a working thing. Horsebacking and hunting was work.
And so how did you evolve into a ski guide?
Well, by the time, I was old enough to start to take things on my own, unfortunately, especially our large mammals population had decreased quite a bit. And, forestry was spreading, logging was spreading into his valley where his hunting territory was. So we knew that that would be, severely, the appeal of that would be really damaged if they clear cut it. And so I kind of thought, okay, the hunting guiding is probably not going to work for me going forward. And I wasn't really very much of a hunter, to be honest. So I thought, okay, let's try recreation. So climbing, skiing, that really appealed to me. I feel like it's more sustainable and you're more, in concert with the environment you're in.
Did you do other jobs before you jumped into the world of backcountry?
Not before, but concurrently. I worked at Pacific Western Airlines and then Canadian Airlines and then Air Canada long enough so they pay me to stay home.
And you just guided as a side hustle?
Yeah, I did. I did every possible thing to get time off. I definitely worked the system.
That eventually evolved into you owning a series of three lodges, Golden Alpine Holidays. Tell us more about that experience.
Yeah, that was a wonderful time. So I was married to one of the Dakin sisters, Allison and Tannis, and Wayne Bingham was a guide with Selkirk Tangiers, and he spotted this area when he was heli-ski guiding, and kind of based on the European concept, decided to put in three huts where you'd have a hut-to-hut system. And, out of a bunch of external circumstances, it ended up with just Allison, Dakin, and myself running the lodges for, I think, all the way to 2010, so 25 years or so of, just being able to spend all winter, not just going ski touring for a week, actually living there, and just an amazing place to go ski touring. Incredible.
And you were guiding, not only operating the lodges, but you were a regular guide throughout the day?
Oh, well, we pretty much, as you know from having your own business, being an owner, you're pretty much cooking, helicopter logistics, trail maintenance, changing the outhouse barrels, all those really glamorous things are all part of the program. And I wouldn't change it for anything. Absolutely. Just a great experience.
You must have met a lot of people that you grew friendships with over the years from all over the world.
Yeah, well, we mostly had either American visitors or Canadian. We didn't have a lot of people from overseas. A few groups from Europe and a few groups from Japan. But in the early time, say the 90s, maybe up to 2004 or 5, 80% American visitors. And then after 2008, or even in the mid-2000s, it kind of switched to more domestic. And then, of course, with I'm out of it now, but I'm in close concert with the current owners. And during the pandemic, it was 100% domestic. So all basically British Columbians when that was required. And then, then the Canadian content kind of figured out what a good value these backcountry lodges were all across all the BLBCA members. And so developed a whole new source of clientele for those lodges.
That kept you busy in the wintertime. The summertime, you were a part of summer camps or with the Alpine Club of Canada, mountaineering camps.
The Alpine Club of Canada's general mountaineering camp, which is their flagship camp, I would say, and started in 1906. So it has a very long history. And my dad started working on the general mountaineering camps with his horses in 1946 in the Bugaboos. So a trip into the Bugaboos then was a 3-day adventure. From there, he continued to provide the horse packing and I call it the ground stuff. So the chefs and people running the camp and people cutting. One person at those camps, all they did was cut firewood. That's all they did every day for the duration of the camp, just to keep the camp running. They had the camps at some points were 220 people. The chefs, cooks were working on wood stoves. So you can kind of sit down and figure out how much work that is, trying to feed 220 people on wood stoves and how hot it would be in the kitchen. I just never envied them the work they had to do.
you continued with those mountaineering camps up until just the last few years, didn't you?
Yeah, so in, I think it must have been in the early 80s, they switched from pack horses to helicopters. And so the camps got to go to more remote locations, and, you know, the helicopter allowed them to explore further afield. And in, I think it was in 1985, the Alpine Club went through a bit of a structural change, and they're actually considering at one point to perhaps stop the General Mountaineering Camp, which had been a tragedy because it's just an iconic long-term thing, which we don't have a lot of. So I offered to take over, you know, completely managing the camp. Basically, I took on the task of doing everything other than providing the guests, which were all Alpine Club members. And so it started out very small. It was definitely in a decline. I think we only ran 2 weeks the first year. And then slowly, particularly with the help of Louise Guy, managed to bring back interest in the camp. And within 5 years, it was back up to 6 weeks, you know, just running really well and really vibrantly. And I stayed with that until 2011, 10 or 11, I can't remember exactly. And then I decided to move on and set up a smaller version of the General Mountaineering Camp called the Boutique Mountaineering Camp, which was just smaller groups and just a little more upscale. So, you know, private individual tents, plated meals, lower guide to client ratios, those kind of things. You know, a shower, power, all in a remote tent camp, if you can kind of imagine. And so I ran that for 8 years, and then I sold that to another person who carried on with it, and that's called the Boutique Mountaineering Camp.
British Columbia, Canada is a backcountry skier's paradise with epic snowfall, vast alpine terrain, and cozy remote backcountry lodges. Your adventure begins here at backcountrylodgesofbc.com. What are some of your favorite memories with your dad? Like, it seems to me that you were in a position out there, like in today's world, there's no way a parent would let a kid do what you were doing.
It was a different time. I think kids weren't quite so bubble wrapped as they are now. I'd be up with just my dad and way up at the headwaters of the Kootenay River in one of his cabins. He had three cabins up there, and he'd want fish for supper. So he'd just send me down to the Kootenay River to catch a couple of fish to bring him home for dinner. Wouldn't even think anything about it. Nowadays, he'd probably get charged with child abandonment if he did that.
Did you encounter any wildlife on the way?
Never anything serious. Yeah, I think. I mean, I was pretty notorious for throwing rocks at things. I was quite a bad kid, actually. And one time, my dad figured that I came running back to camp, so obviously I'd been pretty scared. And so my dad went and looked, and there was wolf tracks. So he figured I was throwing rocks at the wolf. And the wolf wasn't taking too kindly to it. So kind of lucky.
Any other memories that stand out?
You know, an interesting thing with my dad, like, he was the picture of health, but he smoked like a chimney. He was a legendary. He could sit on his pack horse, be leading one horse and rolling a cigarette with the other one. And it was just like following a train engine, just a constant stream of smoke. And, you know, he quit smoking. I was probably 6 or 7. And this is just the kind of guy he was. He just took the cigarette pack, threw it in the bush, and that was it. Never smoked another cigarette, which was a complete boon for me because then he had to have something in his mouth. So he was eating candies all the time. So I could, sneak into one of his pockets, and there's always a treasure waiting for me to grab.
You must have considered yourself pretty lucky to be doing what you were doing at the time.
Absolutely. Even when I was young and you usually don't appreciate those things, I just could kind of tell that this was pretty special. And the only thing that probably rubbed me the wrong way at the time, which now it doesn't, but we had, our horses at that time, 30 or 40, we had them up in the Kootenay Valley in the summer, and then we'd have to trail them over the top of Luxor Pass and back into a little town named Edgewater, which is just north of Invermere, BC, or north of Radium. And then, of course, the horses would be in our winter pasture, which is just down from the town of Edgewater. And I would have to, I'd have to feed them every day. So all my buddies would be going to play hockey at school or doing something, and I'd have to feed the horses. When, by the time you're a late teenager or you're 20-year-old, you kind of think, okay, that was actually pretty good.
You're listening to Mountain Escapes, a backcountry podcast brought to you by the BLBCA, and we're talking with Executive Director Brad Harrison. These days, Brad, you're really connected to the supply side of tourism in BC, adventure tourism mostly. We've had a number of challenging years. That's a fact for backcountry lodge operators as well. Where do you see the industry as it sits now, and where do you see it going?
And that's a really tough question, Jeff. It's got so many different ways you can go with it. So I think there's a ton of opportunity. I think the I've spent a lot of time working with the BC government through many different parties, you know, people in place in government, staff or elected officials. And the current government seems to be placing quite a bit of value on the environment and the biosphere and those things, which is really good. I worry that I hope it's not too late to preserve supernatural BC, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying. I do worry about that though. I mean, one of the big things, I guess, for all of us to consider is the climate situation. You and I both live in Kamloops, where, you know, our ski hill currently has 36 centimeters at the top of the ski hill in December. We have our herb garden still growing in the backyard. It was 8 degrees here yesterday. So, I mean, I think that's really the main concern, because on the positive side, British Columbia is very unique in the world. Where else can you access pristine backcountry so easily? You know, you could fly into Kamloops, in less than 2 hours, you could be in Wells Gray Park, which is a world-class park. There's just not a lot of places that offer that. And we have amazing diversity of wildlife or flora and fauna species, amazing diversity of large mammals. It's an incredible place. We just have to be really diligent in preserving it, keeping it where it's at, making sure it doesn't degrade at all, which is a big task. It's a daunting task.
What are some of the biggest challenges that the lodge operators are facing right now?
It's the regulatory framework by the governments. You know, historically and probably currently to a certain degree, that's maybe changing a bit, doesn't really understand or recognize the value of adventure tourism. British Columbia is still a resource extraction-centric environment. The political environment is centered around resource extraction, and it's partly our fault for not making it clear that adventure tourism is a significant socioeconomic generator in this province, especially in rural BC. All our operators are 32 operators across, I'll call it the southern part of the province, you know, as far north as Smithers and Valmont. They all are very important to those economic drivers in those small communities. We've done a number of surveys, and typically the local purchasing is around over 70%. Typically, they have people that work for them full-time that live in those communities, so their kids are going to school, and they just are generally not given the credit of the importance that they provide. And that's for, I was the chair of the Adventure Tourism Coalition for a number of years, which is 18 different sectors, very diverse. And if you add all them up, I think the last full numbers were the visitor economy, their contribution to visitor economy was $3.2 billion. Which is very significant. And although we hate using sustainable because it's largely overused, but that's, we feel like those kind of opportunities are sustainable, and they are often work much better with what First Nations are looking for as opposed to resource extraction. This isn't adventure tourism instead of resource extraction. It's as well as. We just want to have our voice recognized. I think that's one of the main challenges. And that plays out where if you have a backcountry lodge and there's supposed to be visual quality objectives for timber harvesting, somehow those will often get ignored. And, you know, some of the lodges are worth millions and they've put a lot of money into marketing them. And as soon as they lose the visual quality objective, the value of their lodges obviously goes down. So that's one of our, you know, main focuses with the Adventure Tourism Coalition and the backcountry lodges, with regards to the provincial governments to try and create recognition of the value. We think we can work very well with this resource extraction as long as it's a collegial format.
This is the BLBCA's Mountain Escapes podcast. Thank you for listening. And remember to rate, review, and subscribe on whatever platform you hear us on. Now, back to the podcast. As the owner of Colwest Alpine Adventures, you're kind of in a unique position where you get to train, do avalanche training with a new generation of skiers. Tell me more about that. Has there been a real uptick since COVID in the amount of people that want to get involved in the backcountry?
Well, it's a great question, Jeff, because I live in Kamloops, which is basically nearly a desert. And in terms of when you look at across Avalanche Canada and all their AST providers, for small business operators, not including, the big, like the university avalanche programs and stuff, are very high numbers. Every year we have these meetings and compare numbers, and everybody's trying to figure out how living in Kamloops I can have that many numbers. So that's been really strong for, I don't know, 10 years at least, where all the courses are usually kind of booked and people are trying to get in to later courses, and there's a wait list and all that kind of stuff. And I love doing those courses because you get to work with lots of young people with lots of enthusiasm. And being an old guy, it's really good to work with people that are enthusiastic and want to get out there and want to learn. It's just so rewarding to do that. Generally, I do a course every weekend from the end of November till middle of April, pretty much every weekend, maybe Christmas to get off. But I don't really find it work. I find it pretty enjoyable.
Okay, Brad, we're at that point of the podcast where you get to share a story or two. What have you got for us?
Well, I've had quite a reputation, maybe earned, perhaps not, as being a practical joker. And some of them have gone really well, some maybe not so well, but one of my favorites, when we had the lodges at Golden Alpine, we had three lodges that were probably about 4 or 5 hours ski apart. And we had the Victoria section of the Alpine Club had rented actually two lodges. So two lodges, different valleys, but, side by side. So we had a full moon, which any of you out there who are backcountry skiers or snowshoers, there's nothing like going out under a full moon on your skis or your snowshoes or your snowboard. It's absolutely beautiful. It's riveting. So I convinced, there was a group. So each group had 12 people. So I convinced six of them. We were at our Meadow Lodge. I convinced them to get their skis on and their skins on and their backpack on and leave the lodge at 9 p.m. and head over to Sunrise Lodge, which was, like I said, about 3 to 4 hour ski. So we skied over and they were having a riot at the time. They're all laughing. You could basically read a book pretty much because the moon was so bright. So we skied all the way over to the other lodge, and then the group kind of went into military mode. We put our skins on at the top of the last hill before you get down to the actual lodge in case some of them woke up and, could chase us, and we decided we'd be able to get out of there quickly. So we slid down to the lodge, and everybody took it upon themselves to do some kind of sneaky trick on the unsuspecting people sleeping at Sunrise Lodge. So one person, put cellophane over the toilet seat at the outhouse, both of them. One person tinfoil over the sauna stovepipe so it would smoke the sauna out, and all kinds of things. I decided it would be pretty funny to take one of everybody's pair of skis and hide it under the sauna, except for one person who I knew, and I knew was a practical joker. So I thought I'd leave his skis, thinking that they would never consider that somebody would ski all the way over there, and they would blame him because he had both his skis. So off we went. We went all the way back home to Meadow Lodge. We got home about 3 a.m. They were a lot quieter on the way home than they were on the way over. Everybody's pretty tired. And then we just waited for the morning to come. And of course, unfortunately for me, the other half of the group that didn't do the overnight trip wanted to go skiing right away at 8:30. So I had probably a 3 hour sleep or something, but just waiting on the radio. And sure enough, worked to a T. They blamed, his name was Sandy Briggs. Sandy, if you're out there. And they blamed him for stealing all the skis or hiding all the skis. So that was really quite a good practical joke, I thought.
You've been listening to Mountain Escapes, and we've been chatting with the executive director of the BLBCA, Brad Harrison. My thanks to you for switching gears this time out. I hope you enjoyed being on the other side of the microphone this time.
Thanks very much, Jeff. I wish I would do as good a job as you do.
That's it for this edition of Mountain Escapes, brought to you by the Backcountry Lodges of BC Association. Please check out our other podcasts, where you'll hear about Tayac's Adventures, the Bernie Glacier Chalet, Battle Abbey, Ice Creek Lodge, Blanket Glacier Chalet, and many others. You can listen to all of that on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks for listening, and stay safe in the backcountry.